Well, sit back and enjoy and relax tonight's Coast to Coast program. What a ride it will be. We'll be back with Mark McCandlish on Coast to Coast AM. Mark McCandlish grew up with an interest in aircraft and other modes of transportation from a very early age. He joined the Air Force and later made use of the GI Bill to attend the Art Center College of Design. He later worked for a short time in the Hollywood special effects business as a matte artist and then was hired by the General Dynamics Corporation in California as a technical illustrator and technical publications editor. Now, during this time, Mark also was given the opportunity to participate in a number of media orientation rides in frontline U.S. Air Force and Air National Guard fighters such as the F-15 Eagle and the F-16 Fighting Falcon. In 1986, Mr. McCandlish became aware that the U.S. military was in possession of some extraordinary technologies and began to pursue his own private research into where it came from, how it works, and this research led to many strange events and encounters for him. Mark is back on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Mark, it's been well over a year. How are you?
Good, George. Thank you so much for having me back.
Oh, my pleasure. Lots I want to talk with you about, especially this kind of information that you were able to get. But I just find out in some of our notes that you are a staunch believer in our mass consciousness, mass prayer experiments.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I've seen evidence of that in my own life, and I've seen evidence of it in some of the things that you've done on the air. In fact, I knew Elizabeth Targ personally. She was an acquaintance of mine. I was a friend of her husband, Mark Cummings.
Mm-hmm.
And as you probably know, she was the daughter of Russell Targ, who worked with Hal Puthoff at SRI
right.
to start up the technical remote viewing program a number of years ago. But in fact, I met her right before she was unfortunately diagnosed with the brain cancer that ultimately ended her life. And was a participant in the prayers that were directed at her unfortunate situation. So,
well,
a little bit about that. In fact, her husband did a lot to acquaint me with her research and had talked extensively about some of the things that she had found in her research, including the fact that there is clinical proof that people who have others into other individuals praying for them have shown an improvement in their ability to heal and in eventually sustaining a cure for some diseases. And in fact, it turns out that the more individuals that pray for the person who is sick, the better the chances are. And in fact, if that person happens to know that this process is going on, they have an even greater opportunity for healing. And if the individuals, the people out there that are doing the praying, if they know who this person is and where they're located, all of these things improve the chances of that process being successful.
You know, because, Mark, you have a special request tonight, and I just got an email in from the mother of a young lad. Her name is Connie. Her son's name is Kevin. And he has end-stage liver cancer, needs a new liver very soon, or she says his time is very short otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your situation as well, and I want to group this together.
Okay.
We normally, on Fridays, I just remind people about, you know, using their mass consciousness, their prayer, mm-hmm. to do what they can for the good of people. And I think that's been pretty sufficient to help a lot of people. But in these two isolated cases, you have a request, and Connie has a request for her son, and I thought we'd just put them together.
Well, I think it's a wonderful idea. And just as an aside, my father also had liver cancer a number of years ago. It was probably about 25 years ago when he was first diagnosed around 1980, 1981. And he valiantly went through a number of cycles of chemo and radiation treatment, and in fact, they had to remove about two-thirds of his liver. In fact, what a lot of people don't know is that the liver is the one organ in the body that actually has the capability of regenerating itself. And so for the next 6 months, he was on a high nutritional diet to help that process take place. But unfortunately, they found after a successful surgery and after the cancer had gone into remission, that and this is back before the blood supply had been screened, but that he had picked up hepatitis C during the surgery from a blood transfusion.
Bad
and
blood,
ultimately, that was what killed him.
Gosh.
After everything else had gone so well, you know. So this is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. And so just to give you a little background, my cousin Randy Foster, who lives down in Texas, was actually a swift boat crewman during the Vietnam War, and he came back and has had a number of relationships, but the one that has really been the longest lasting and the most the deepest love that I've ever ever had the recollection of his having was with this this lady who's I guess she has a partly Native American background. Her name is Cheryl Dusty, and she actually headed into a university medical center in Dallas, Texas, in the 3500 block of Gaston Avenue in Dallas, Texas. I wasn't sure whether it was okay to directly identify the hospital, but as long as the audience knows very, very close to what the specific location is of the individual that these prayers are going to be focused on, I think that this all plays into the data that was collected by Elizabeth Targ. Now, the problem that she has is that she has contracted leukemia, and so what I would like to do as a part of this prayer process, this mass prayer process that we're going to initiate, is for the audience to focus on the bone marrow and the production of healthy blood cells within the body of Cheryl Dusty near the 3500 block of Gaston Avenue in Dallas, Texas, USA. And what was the name of the young man who...
Kevin, who needs a new liver. So I guess the best we can do for that is hope and pray that he holds on until he gets it.
Mm-hmm. Now, do we know what his last name is?
No, she didn't give us his last name.
Oh.
But a lot of times they don't do that in an email, Mark.
Yeah. Do we know what city he's in?
Well, let's see where she may be. No, we don't know his city either.
Well, you know, the best we can do then is to hope that anyone who has the name Kevin and needs a new liver will benefit from the process. But what I would like to do is just take a moment and have the audience focus their thoughts on this nice young lady, Cheryl Dusty, in the 3500 block of Gaston Avenue in Dallas, Texas tonight, who's going to be starting chemotherapy this week. It'll be lasting for 3 weeks. And focus, imagine, visualize in your mind the bone marrow throughout her entire body, through her entire skeleton. Imagine that bone marrow healing itself and returning to a state of normalcy, where the genetic problem that gives rise to leukemia is corrected, and that the tissue there returns to a healthy state. And that's what I would ask your audience to think about and to do when they have a moment. Maybe even, you know, stand up, close your eyes, and face in the general direction of Dallas, Texas, from wherever you might be on the face of the planet, and just send those positive thoughts in that direction. And that's what I would ask. If you'll pardon the Christian bias, in Jesus' name we pray, amen.
All right, very good, Mark. And for Kevin, he's got a blog. His mother has a blog called newliverforkevin.blogspot.com. And people can go to that as well. Mark, on to the work at hand here. How did you become aware of some of these extraordinary technologies that the military possessed?
Well, in the early 1980s, I had... been contacted by a fellow who was an Air National Guard pilot with the Missouri Air National Guard. I think he was based in St. Louis, but he actually worked at an advertising agency in Los Angeles. And I was doing a number of illustrations for the Lockheed Corporation through their advertising agency in L.A. In fact, I was living near L.A. at the time. And he indicated that there was this process available where people who were involved in media and media advertising and any sort of publications in the media that had to do with the aerospace industry were good candidates for what they called media orientation rides. And this is something that you see baseball players and mayors and things. They'll go up with the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds or one of these teams. But there's also the opportunity through Air National Guard, Air Force, and Navy squadrons to experience this. And the whole idea behind this is it's really an opportunity, a great public affairs opportunity for the different branches of the service to show people in the civilian world what it takes to be a successful participant in the military, particularly when it has to do with these multi-million dollar aircraft that can easily cost $45 million to well over $100 million a pop, and show the public that they're truly getting their money's worth when it comes to the maintenance, the expertise, the design, and the capabilities of these aircraft. And in my instance, I had an opportunity to go up five different times, twice in the F-4 Phantom, once in the F-16, once in the F-15, and one in the A-7K, which is a two-seat version of the A-7 Corsair II. And I actually got some stick time in the back seat where I had the opportunity to actually fly the aircraft, which was absolutely thrilling. But during this process, I had an occasion to talk to a number of pilots, and there was this rumor going around about this new secret aircraft at the time was being referred to as the F-19. Nobody really knew what it looked like, but during the different occasions when I was doing artwork for the ad agencies that covered the accounts of Northrop, McDonnell Douglas, Lockheed, General Dynamics, and McDonnell Douglas, there were a lot of what I would call generic illustrations that were requested by these different defense contractors having to do with a new, what was being called the Advanced Tactical Fighter, I believe, mm-hmm. at the time. It was a new program. It was, they were looking forward to the time when the F-15 and the F-16 were going to be phased out. They were looking for a multi-role fighter, something that could fight in good weather or bad, night or day, just about anywhere in the world that had a really substantial range, and started to employ some of the qualities of stealth that were only beginning to be hinted at in the media. The production and the development of the stealth fighter itself, the F-117A, goes all the way back to the mid to late 1970s. The program actually started up around 1977, as I recall, and the first test flights of the program, I believe, was called Half Blue, began out at Area 51 around, I believe it was 1981, 1982. And so these were things that, there was rumors and things. And so the F-19 was the only information that anybody had about what this aircraft might be or what it might look like, what it might be able to do. And the pilots had been hearing about it, but they really didn't know any more than I think most of the readers of Aviation Week and Space Technology had to know about it. But then one day, I was approached by Lockheed to do one of these fictitious aircraft. And I was approached by some public affairs people with their Calabasas division, which no longer exists, north and west of Los Angeles.
Yeah, not too far from our Sherman Oaks studios.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Right where that is.
Yeah.
But they said that they had a new aircraft. It was going to be the second generation in a series of aircraft, a family of aircraft that had a very colorful history, was very fast, flew very high. Most of the details about the aircraft were considered classified. And so they really couldn't tell me anything about the aircraft, but what they wanted me to do was come up with a piece of conceptual artwork that would show a completely fictitious aircraft that looked very fast and very mean and aggressive and all the things that the military likes to sort of feel when they look at one of their airplanes. I mean, if you've ever seen an F-16, it just bristles with military application.
Oh, absolutely. It's
so I went home with this little bit of information that I had, And after I had had lunch with this gentleman and we discussed this, as the meeting was sort of coming to the close, he said to me, well, you know, we actually have a, sort of an earlier version of this same aircraft that's in deployment right now. And he said, it's starting to get a little long in the tooth. We're having some problems. And he said, in fact, we had one of these aircraft not too long ago that was coming into Edwards Air Force Base from a mission, and it actually had two different propulsion systems, one that would allow it to take off and land, and another one that would begin to become active after it had reached some of the higher speed it was capable of on the engines that you know, allowed it to land and take off. And that the pilot was apparently having difficulty transitioning from the high-speed engines to the ones that would allow it to land. And so the military, not wanting it to crash in any populated area or, you know, anywhere someone could see what this classified aircraft looked like, directed the pilot to take the aircraft out over the engine, or out over the ocean, excuse me.
Yes.
And that it took the pilot 15 minutes to sort out whatever it was that was preventing him from transitioning from the high-speed to the low-speed engines. And by that time, he was over Hawaii in 15 minutes from Edwards Air Force Base to Hawaii. So, I mean,
that doesn't happen, Mark.
No. But, and this was right about the time that all the seismic sensors in Southern California were starting to pick up these sonic booms that were setting off the, you know, and they were tracking these things transitioning through and the Los Angeles area at sort of southwest to northeast trajectory towards Area 51 at speeds approaching Mach 4, Mach 5. So, you know, I don't suppose this public affairs guy thought that as an artist, you know, and as a nuts and bolts kind of guy who likes to work on cars and, you know, has a little bit of involvement with the numbers and the engineering, I guess he just never thought that I would go home and look at a map and figure out that it was 3,000 miles from Edwards to Hawaii. And if you can do 3,000 miles in a quarter of an hour, that means if you take a whole hour of time, you'd be going 12,000 miles an hour. Now that's, you know, I couldn't tell you what the Mach number for that is, but it's a real, real high number.
Yes, it is.
And, of course, you know, it's affected by the altitude because the density of air is less and less as you go higher and higher. So if you have an aircraft that's traveling in extremely high altitude, it affects what the Mach number actually is. But so I couldn't tell you what 12,000 miles an hour is, but this was the first generation version of whatever the aircraft was. Now, I know that almost 10 years later, I was approached by Rockwell International to do some conceptual art on a proposed aircraft that they had codenamed HYSTEP, which was spelled H-Y-S-T-P, which meant a hypersonic testbed program. Now, their aircraft had some similarities to what eventually was designed, what I designed for Lockheed, you know, in 1985, 1986, in this conceptual artwork that I'd done, but that this concept they were talking about, they said it was capable of 17,000 miles an hour, which just happens to be the velocity to escape the Earth's pull. You know,
at any point though, Mark, did they ever tell you where they got this technology?
Well, I think that this sort of thing was really a byproduct of advanced materials research, where they started finding things like titanium aluminide and these different aluminum titanium composite materials, different structures that could handle the kind of extreme heat that was generated by an aircraft moving through the air at these extremely high Mach numbers. I mean, the whole reason the space shuttle itself is covered with tiles is because if it came into the atmosphere, it just made out of metal, it would burn to a crisp, as we've seen, unfortunately, with the Columbia.
All right, well, let's find out if it's alien or captured technology when we come back. Okay, Mark, the aircraft, captured technology, or did we develop this on our own?
Well, I think this particular type of aircraft we were talking about before is probably aircraft that we developed on our own. The material science that went into some of these things may have been, you know, back engineered from something that they had found at one time or another, but it sounded to me like the progression of the engineering that went into these aircraft was really dependent on the kinds of material science that you know was pretty much something that the aerospace community seemed to be aware of, you know, these developments that were going on. In fact, just to back up a little bit on the story about the work I did for Lockheed on this conceptual illustration for the second generation of aircraft in this one particular family, I was asked to do this illustration. I went home and I started looking around at the different aircraft, the ones that you know we know to be fast, like the SR-71 Blackbird, mm-hmm. and there was a Mach 3 capable aircraft that was designed by Rockwell back in the 1960s. It was called the XB-70. It was called the nickname the Valkyrie, and it was a big white aircraft. One of which unfortunately crashed near Edwards Air Force Base, but the other one is currently at the Air Force Museum at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. But this aircraft, like the SR-71, had a large delta-shaped or triangular-shaped main wing, had two tails or vertical stabilizers, you know, out over the midpoint of the wing on each side. And in the case of the SR-71, it had a long fuselage that extended out ahead of that. Now, in the case of the SR-71, it had a chine, which is kind of like a razor edge that ran right out of the edge, the leading edge of the main wing, right up along the sides of the aircraft, all the way up to the nose, which was part of its design for thwarting radar reflectivity and trying to keep it as stealthy as possible. Now, the XB-70 had a long kind of a gooseneck sort of fuselage extension from the main wing that terminated in a cockpit, and above and behind the cockpit were these large wings. It was like a canard that was somewhat smaller than the main wing, but it created the ability to control where the front end of the aircraft went a little bit better. So I looked at these two aircraft, you know, both of them capable of something between Mach 2 and Mach 3, and I decided to incorporate features of both of the aircraft, and what I wound up developing looked an awful lot like an XB-70 with the chine and the canards that you'd find on both those aircraft, a chine running up along a gooseneck-shaped forward fuselage, and then a set of canards that came right out of the edge on each side of the fuselage. And so I brought this illustration, and one of the other changes that I'd made was that I'd moved the vertical stabilizers way out to the wingtips, you know, sort of like the winglets that you see on some modern aircraft, only yeah. much larger. Fully movable control surfaces, and I thought I, you know, had a really great looking, fast looking aircraft. I had converted the engines into two boxes, one under each wing, something like the SST supersonic, the Concorde transport that used to fly, and gave it sort of a rectangular but slanted inlet that was somewhat reminiscent of the proposal they had for supersonic combustion or scramjet engines that were being talked about at that time. So I combined all these elements, and I brought my sketch pad in, and this gentleman from the Public Affairs Department introduced me to a couple of engineers that were sitting there, not giving their names, but just saying, you know, they're here to evaluate your drawing.
Right. Did you feel at all, Mark, though, that they were holding back something from you?
Oh, well, yeah. They clearly were. And yeah. the thing that was funny about it was that I unveiled this drawing, and rather than being met with approval and, you know, oh, that's a great looking, you know, that looks fast kind of comment,
yeah.
what I got was one of the two engineers, his hands began to tremble. He got very red in the face, and he just said, well, what are these canards about, and what are those vertical stabilizers doing? He moved out of the wingtip. I mean, those would be torn off at Mach 7. And then he started to say Mach 17, and he cut himself off. And then I knew that what I had drawn apparently looked so much like something that was already on the drawing board
right.
that this guy was genuinely concerned that there was a leak
somebody
somewhere
leaked,
in the midst
somebody
of all
leaked
this
you.
Going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was about 1986. It was about 5 or 6 years later that there was actually a number of sightings of this particular kind of aircraft, or one that looked an awful lot like what I had drawn, not only near Edwards Air Force Base. It was a big storm center over Area 51, and it was broad daylight on a Sunday, and a guy had pulled off of the one of the state routes that runs just north of Edwards, and he had stopped just north of a Lockheed facility near Helensdale, California. And this giant, big, white aircraft came flying in right over the top of him as he was relieving himself. It was basically right under the flight pattern for Helensdale, which is a Lockheed facility, and it actually has an underground hangar that you can see from some of the aerial photographs that are available on the Internet.
Why did they want you to illustrate when, in many cases, they already had the craft?
Well, in this particular case, this aircraft had not been built yet, and one of the things that conceptual artwork was used for up until the advent of computer-generated imagery was to help a defense contractor promote the concept before they spend millions of dollars on engineering and developing parts and all this kind of stuff. They would have someone like me create a piece of conceptual artwork that they could then take to a Defense Appropriations Committee and say, this is what the thing is going to look like when it's flying or and dropping bombs, shooting missiles, or, you know, spying on, you know, whoever, taking pictures from extremely high altitudes. This is what it'll look like. And this is our concept for the vehicle. So that was, it was basically to help congressmen and senators who, you know, may not have a very good imagination to at least see what they envisioned the aircraft looking like when it was finally built.
Now, and again, though, did anybody ever leak to you that they got this technology from extraterrestrials?
Not where the advanced jet aircraft were concerned. There never really was anybody who ever suggested to me that those particular types of vehicles involved technology that came from somewhere other than this planet.
What did you think?
Well, I accepted that because there'd been a lot of talk in the defense media, Aviation Week, and Space Technology, and a number of other defense industry publications, all suggested that these kinds of areas were being researched and researched heavily because at that time, one of the things they thought would give a strategic advantage to our military aircraft was being able to go really, really fast. Really fast and really high. And the higher and faster you could go, the greater the chances were that you would be able to outrun anything that they shot at you, including some of their high-speed missiles. And so this was the kind of philosophy that they had developed at that point, but eventually I think they realized it's one of the reasons that led to the demise of the XB-70 and other aircraft that you know, were capable of extremely high speeds, was that it was just as well that you know, our enemies could go out and build even faster anti-aircraft missiles. And so they started relying more on a way of finessing their way around that problem, and that was the advent of stealth, finding a way that the systems that a missile relies on for its targeting of an aircraft would be difficult to rely on in terms of you know, making contact with the target and bringing it down. One of the things that, of course, a lot of the older pilots are familiar with is something called chaff, where you would throw a lot of particles of aluminum out into the air, and it would create a big cloud, a reflection that an incoming missile, would think was the airplane, and it would usually these things, many of them,
hopefully hit that and not the craft.
Well, the idea was that many of these missiles often relied on what they called a proximity fuse or proximity detonation, where when it sensed that it was as close to the aircraft as it would possibly be, the warhead would go off, and it would send shrapnel in all directions, hoping that it would take out vital parts of the aircraft. If it didn't make a direct hit on the engines, at least it might, you know, hurt the pilot or the electronics or a control surface in a way that the plane would go out of control, begin to tumble, and eventually disintegrate. So in the case of infrared, and this is something that they still use today over in Afghanistan and Iraq, is when a jet aircraft or even a turbojet-powered prop-driven aircraft takes off, a lot of times you'll see them dropping flares, and that is intended to fool missiles that are based on a heat-seeking or an infrared technology that track or target the heat produced by the engines. Now, one of the more innovative things that the Israelis came up with during the Six-Day War with, I think it was Egypt, is they went out and got a bunch of this galvanized corrugated roofing, and they basically formed a tube and pop riveted these things together, and then they basically bolted them to the end of their jet airplanes, so that it made it appear as though the exhaust port on the back of the aircraft was about 10 feet behind the plane. And so when the Egyptians shot heat-seeking missiles at them, the missile would go off about 15, 20 feet behind the aircraft. And in most cases, they were able to get back to their airport or their air bases without being harmed, because they were actually able to make the missile think that the exhaust for the plane was in a different spot than it really was. Now, they have new technology that has come about in the last 15 years or so that can actually produce a fake or a phantom IR signature that stands away from the aircraft, so that these missiles are fooled even further. But the old standby, the most reliable method, is to just drop flares.
Okay, but at this time, you haven't been convinced that it's extraterrestrial technology. Did that change to this date?
Well, since that time, about right around 1988, I had done some illustrations for Popular Science and Popular Mechanics, and an old friend of mine from college had seen one of these cover illustrations, recognized the name, and tracked me down through the art director. And I had suggested to him that we go see an air show that was right in my neighborhood. I was living in Rialto at the time, and this was over at Norton Air Force Base in San Bernardino, which is about 65, 70 miles east of downtown Los Angeles, right along Interstate 10. The base is now closed, as far as I know, but they usually had the Thunderbirds there flying over the weekend, and they were talking about having an SR-71 on static display, which at that time was, you know, a pretty big deal, because not too many people had seen these things up close. So I had made plans to go with this friend of mine, and we had set a specific time and place to rendezvous, and then at the last minute I got a call from the magazine Popular Science again to do their February cover story about the X-31, and so I was unable to attend. And about a week later I got back in touch with my friend and asked him about the air show, and he said that he had enjoyed it, but that he had seen some things that he felt that he wasn't supposed to see.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, how's that possible? The only stuff they have on display at the
air show is what
they
want you to see.
Are you know, the exhibits that they intend for you to look at. He says, well, there's this giant hangar there. It looks like four giant Quonset Hut hangars all sort of constructed together, and there's some shops around the edges. And he said, they had an exhibit inside there that the fellow that I was going to introduce you to at the air show, he took me in, he escorted me in, as introduced me as his aide, and he took me into this this exhibit, and he says there were a lot of high-ranking military brass and a number of senators and congressmen there, and he said that he got inside, and as soon as they went in there, now you have to remember this is, I believe it was November 12th, 1988, which is about 2 weeks before they released the first grainy photographs of the F-117A stealth fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And about a month before they released the first sort of rough illustrations of the Northrop B-2 bomber. Now, as soon as they got inside, the gentleman that this friend of mine was with said, that he had made a big mistake, and that there were actually some other aircraft in this hangar that he felt that my friend was not supposed to see.
Yeah,
and
so he's got to get out of there. Right?
He says, you know, the fact that you're here, he says, you know, we really can't back up on this. He said, you just kind of, you know, enjoy the show. Don't talk to anybody. Don't ask any questions. Just, you know.
Or we kill you, right?
Well, I mean, it didn't go quite that far, but basically he felt that he had kind of overstepped the bounds of what the security protocols were, and that the best way to stay out of trouble on this was to just not say anything about it and to just, you know, keep quiet. Well, so as it turns out, it wasn't until several years later that I eventually heard that that not only had the exhibit taken partly had partly taken place at Norton Air Force Base, but that in fact the participants, the people who had been invited into this exhibit, were all loaded onto a military airliner, like a, you know, a 727. I'm not sure what the military designation for that is, but they were flown up to Plant 42 up near Lancaster and Palmdale, which is the location of the Lockheed Skunk Works, and they were brought into the Lockheed facility itself at Skunk Works, and that's where the main exhibit was. And among the various aircraft there were a number of advanced hovercraft. There were, in fact, I plan to have a few illustrations of this stuff up on my website before very much longer.
What about the large triangular-shaped object that everybody has seen nowadays?
Well, now, you know, there are probably three different categories of aircraft that that could be. The smallest of which is referred to as the TR-3A, sometimes called the Black Manta. There's been some discussion about it being in deployment since about the time of the Persian Gulf War, which is around 1991, as a laser designator type, a target designator aircraft that worked in concert with the stealth fighters, that these aircraft would go in at a higher altitude. They would, you know, pick the particular target or bunker that the stealth fighters were going to launch against, and then they would illuminate the target with the laser, and the
lock
the,
right in
the,
on it.
The laser-guided bombs that were dropped by the stealth fighters would then, you know, fly into the target and go off. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about whether the aircraft was actually built. Most people think that it was constructed by Lockheed, but I have a number of reliable witnesses that have all said that they saw the aircraft being launched from McDonnell Douglas's aircraft construction facility in Long Beach around between 1990 and 1992.
Okay, but that's not a huge object.
No,
right?
No, it's probably 40 feet long and about 60 feet wide.
Okay.
And that's a jet conventionally powered jet aircraft with stealth capabilities, basically shaped like a triangular-shaped flying wing is what it really is. Now, the next category would be something approaching the size of a stealth bomber, probably something on the order of, in fact, the first Aurora aircraft looked somewhat like a triangle. It was more of a diamond shape, longer on the front half than it was on the back. But the largest of the three is an aircraft that came under a program for Lockheed called Stealth 330, and it's basically a stealth blimp.
Triangular shaped?
Yes, up to about 600 feet in length.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that and the propulsion system of some of these vehicles. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Mark McClandish. Our guest. Okay, Mark, you got to tell us about this 600-foot triangular-shaped object, which so many people have witnessed. As a matter of fact, I'm broadcasting now in a cave near St. Louis, and several years ago, several officers, four of them from Milstead, Illinois, saw one of these, and I think it was parked near Scott Air Force Base. Might I be right on that?
Well, the actual base, I'm not really sure about. I've heard that there is a facility down near Florida where some of these things have been seen quite often as well. And also in upper state New York, the Hudson Valley sightings tend to go along with some of the descriptions that we've had of this particular type of craft. Now, the interesting thing here is that, you know, so many people are just not used to seeing airships anymore, like the Goodyear blimp, for example, is an airship. And it basically uses the buoyancy of a really lighter-than-air gas to keep it aloft.
Mm-hmm.
But since the advent of dirigibles, or blimps as they are sometimes called, many years ago in the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, the material science, the kinds of materials that went into the construction of these things have improved so much. You have materials now that are hundreds of times stronger than the kinds of materials that used to be used, maybe even 1,000 times stronger.
And lighter. And
oh,
lighter.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so when you look at the possibility of using materials that not only are stronger and lighter, but can be put together in such a way to create a strong structural fuselage or body of a vehicle like that with absolutely no steel whatsoever, you're talking about an aircraft that can lift a tremendous amount of weight and at the same time is almost completely invisible to radar. The radar, the radio frequency energy of the radar just simply goes right through it and doesn't reflect back off of it. And then if you augment that by coating it with some of the special paint that they used both on the SR-71 and on the stealth fighter, the so-called, I think it was called iron ball paint, which has particles suspended in the paint that absorb the radio frequency energy and actually sort of re-radiate it as heat. So it's dissipated, and it just converts the kind of energy and dissipates it as heat. But you take all those things and you combine them, and you have the ability to logistically to move a tremendous amount of men and material in a very stealthy way and very quietly.
And very slowly, though, isn't it?
Or well, is, I mean, you know, I suppose the top speed of something like this would be probably in the regime of, you know, 350 to 400 miles an hour, which, by the way, if you go back to the Phoenix Lights sightings of, I think it was March 13th, 1997, over Phoenix, if you go and you chart all the locations and the times, starting south of, I think it was, what is the air base in Las Vegas there? Nellis Air Force Base.
Nellis.
If you start at Henderson with the first sighting, you go down through Flagstaff or Prescott Payson, through the areas just north of Phoenix and down all the way to Tucson. If you chart, you know, point to distance, you find that if the times are accurate based on the eyewitness accounts, this thing never traveled any faster than 450 miles an hour. Which is fully within the capabilities of an aircraft of this kind. You know, even using internally buried jet engines with long sound-suppressed tubes that would allow the air to be sucked into the aircraft, into a jet engine, and then vented out through a discharge nozzle, perhaps up on the top of the vehicle, that can be rotated in multiple directions, just like the snorkels that they have on some of these hovercraft that are used over in Great Britain and other places. You can direct, it's called vectored thrust, and you can redirect the thrust from the engines that are buried deep inside the vehicle so that the sound is suppressed. They also have technology for acoustically canceling the noise from the jet engines by introducing a very loud signal that is basically 180 degrees out of sync with the noise that's produced by the jet engine. It completely cancels in about 95% cancellation of the noise. You just don't hear anything.
Isn't it also painted on the bottom as if it's a star chart?
Well, you know, something that has been described on a number of occasions, that these vehicles either look like a soap bubble, they look like they were transparent, or they actually look like they had some kind of a lighting array on the bottom that generated a moving but artificial star field on the other side. Now, I actually spoke to an individual. I had a girlfriend who had a gallery in Big Bear Lake who a number of years ago opened the gallery, and I was there for that. And I met a number of people who actually worked at the Northrop B-2 bomber production mm-hmm. facility. And we started talking about these kind of things. And one of the ladies said that one night that they had, in fact, seen one of these immense, you know, 600-foot-long, you know, 350, 400-foot-wide triangular-shaped things hovering right over Plant 42 in the Lancaster-Palmdale area. It was absolutely silent. And she had described this very thing, this feature that appeared to be sort of an active skin, if you will, that had, I don't know, maybe some kind of LED lights or something built right into the skin. And so it could create a fake, an artificial star field.
Yeah.
that wouldn't necessarily match the star field that was directly above it, but that, you know, by having this illusion of, you know, stars of various magnitudes, some being faint, some being brighter, moving across the bottom of the aircraft at the same pace and in the opposite direction of the vehicle's travel, you could create the illusion that there was just nothing there. Aside from the fact that the Los Angeles area, including the Lancaster, Palmdale, Mojave area, gets an awful lot of smog from the Los Angeles basin. Mm-hmm. And so the city lights have a tendency to illuminate that smog, especially in the summertime and the fall. And so the sky has sort of this orange glow to it, and no matter how hard you try to shield the underside of a huge aircraft like that with a fake star field, it just happens to be silhouetted against this smog that goes up several thousand feet in altitude, and so it's
right.
Silhouetted as this big dark object. You just can't miss it.
How high up does this object go?
Well, you know, there's some debate. I was told on one occasion by an employee from Lockheed that they had developed a new kind of silica-based aerogel that actually could be dispensed from the payload bay of the space shuttle while it was in outer space, and that this gel could be catalyzed and sprayed out into space, and these little bubbles of gas would expand into this almost like soap suds that would solidify into a very very soft and but brittle kind of a glassy foam, if you will. very, very lightweight, and that these things could be encapsulated in these large sort of balloons or bags, I guess you'd call them, and that the bags themselves had a kind of thin wiring that ran along the length of the skin, the bag, that would contain all of this stuff, and that by putting an electrical charge on these wires, they could actually make this thing fly down into the atmosphere and move around through the atmosphere like a giant floating compass needle, if you will. One of the experiments we did when we were little kids in school is you take a needle and you very gently lay it down on the water, and the surface tension will make it float. And if it's made out of steel or iron, the needle will actually turn around and point in the direction of the North Pole. So if you put an electrical charge on an object of this size, even if it's a relatively minor electric charge, and you augment that by the static electricity that builds up as this body, this huge thing, begins to pass down through the air, it's very possible to be using the movement of air over the surface to create an electrostatic charge that actually powers your flight control system. I mean, it's remarkable the things that they can do.
Mark, the craft that you'd mentioned last hour that went about 17,000 miles an hour,
yes.
What kind of propulsion system do you think it had?
Now, that particular aircraft, I eventually was told that it actually had three different propulsion systems. The one was basically sort of a high-bypass turbojet engine, kind of like what you would find in the old SR-71 Blackbird, buried up inside the fuselage. And then the early versions had what amounted to what has been called a linear aerospike engine. Basically, the whole back end of the aircraft was sort of like a tapered but flattened out cone, and they would spray fuel from a ridge that ran laterally across the aircraft. And as soon as it hit this extremely high pressure, high speed, superheated air flowing over the front of the aircraft, it would spontaneously explode. And it would expand, the exploding fuel would expand between the tapered afterbody of the vehicle and the supersonic shockwave that would slant back and away from this ridge, the point of separation, and would actually push this thing forward. Now, in a previous program with Art, I had mentioned that this was kind of like taking a wet pumpkin seed and squeezing it between your fingers. You know, by putting the pressure both above and below the afterbody of the aircraft, you put pressure on it, you can push it forward at a tremendous velocity. Someone heard that particular statement, and they thought that the code name for the vehicle was the pumpkin seed. Well, it's not. That was just something that someone picked up and began circulating. So that is not the name. It was actually called the Lockheed Pulsar, I believe. But it came under a family of aircraft that later became known as Aurora.
That's right, and we've heard a lot about that. Well, now, everything that you have handled, Mark, or investigated, at any point did you stumble across aliens, for example, that might have been captured or contained?
Well, I did. And not that I ever actually saw any of these things personally myself, but part of my logic, one of the other things that had occurred in this business with Norton Air Force Base and the exhibit that was given at the Lockheed Skunk Works was that there were also three flying saucers on display there, approximately 24, 60, and about 120 to 130 feet in diameter, all hovering off the floor with nothing suspending them in the way of cables from the ceiling or landing gear. And they were referred to as alien reproduction vehicles. Now, there have been a number of people who've called into question the veracity, the honesty of the eyewitness. And you know, it might be easy to discount this story entirely, except that there are probably a dozen other people that I've talked to who either have worked on this thing, have seen it, or have relatives who've worked on it. And so there's no question in my mind that it actually exists. But the real question is whether or not it was back engineered from technology that was captured at some time in the past, in the U.S. history's past, probably, you know, something dating back to the 1940s, 1945 to 1947.
Roswell, do you think?
Well, that's one possibility. Interestingly, there's sort of a tie-in between stealth and those original incidents, because one of the few kinds of radar systems that has the potential of detecting a stealth aircraft, and there was a lot of question about how effective the Northrop B-2 bomber would be, because there was a radar system under development that was called UWB. It was ultra-wideband radar. And because it broadcasts on a number of frequencies simultaneously, it has the ability to sort of silhouette the target, even if the target has the ability to limit radar reflectivity, even absorbing some of the reflectivity, because of the fact that it's broadcasting on a number of frequencies simultaneously, it has the ability to sort of isolate this pocket that doesn't reflect anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that the very first and the most rudimentary radar systems that the U.S. military developed, which happened to be down in the area of Mexico and Four Corners, where the Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado come together, was a radar system that had this unusual characteristic. Because it was so rudimentary, because they hadn't refined the technology, it just happened to have the ability to broadcast on a number of frequencies very sort of in a dirty way, sort of staticky, if you will, in terms of the terminology that you want to use. But because of that, it's been discussed and rumored, and some people have claimed that it was this very aspect of the radar's transmission, this multi-spectral wide-spectrum broadcast, that had the ability to jam the control systems of some of these vehicles that started showing up in the skies of Earth after we began detonating nuclear weapons. Now, the story goes that something about the way that we built these weapons, the way they went off, the electromagnetic nuclear pulse, sent out a signal, a signature, if you will, that told somebody somewhere else, maybe in the next star system over, that, the boys on Earth have cracked the atom finally. We need to go check out their progress and see if they're going to destroy themselves.
Right, they're coming along. Exactly.
And so if you look at the time between the first detonations of nuclear weapons, probably, I don't remember the exact, the first test I think was in 1944, and the first actual use in warfare was, I believe, August of 1945. But, you look at that, and it's 1947, which is supposedly the first downed extraterrestrial vehicle at Roswell. It's 2 years later, and so if you look at the distances between stars and the possibility of traveling at superluminal or faster than light speeds, you have the potential of having somebody from somewhere else saying, we need to go there and see what the guys on Earth are doing. But so Roswell wasn't the only incident. There were also incidents, crashes that occurred at Aztec, New Mexico, a site which I've actually visited. Roswell, Socorro, New Mexico, or is it Mexico? I forget. Paradise, Arizona. There was one near somewhere near Flagstaff, I believe it was, as well. So, if you look at these, and they all sort of form a circle around the area where these radar tests were being done, and so it tends to make one believe that there really was something to the story about this particular kind of air radar interfering with their guidance control systems.
It is amazing, that story and all the others too, Mark, isn't it?
Well, I find that when this all started, I was really quite skeptical. I felt that perhaps, one of these early scientists like Nikola Tesla or someone who actually described aircraft designs, he called using an electron wind. And if you look at some of the designs that were published, some of the things that he had proposed, they bear a striking resemblance to the components that are now alleged to be a part of these propulsion systems, which I'll be able to describe in one of the next segments. But my skepticism led me to look everywhere, not just in the aerospace industry, not just people who said they'd seen lights in the sky, but people who are also claiming to be part of the abduction phenomenon. My logic, my thinking was that if these people really had been abducted and they really were awake during any part of that experience, there was a slight possibility that maybe they saw some of these propulsion system components.
Sure.
And in fact, after hearing the description of what the components in the alien reproduction vehicle were actually supposed to look like, and without really ever disclosing some of those facts to the people that I interviewed who were claiming to be abductees,
right,
it was startling very startling just how close they got to describing some of those components that were allegedly a part of the ARV, the Alien Reproduction Vehicle's propulsion system. I mean, one of the most pronounced features is a large central column that runs right up through the middle of the vehicle.
Does it rotate?
I beg your pardon?
Does it rotate?
In some cases, it does. It depends on the kind of propulsion system. In the case of the ones that were witnessed in these alien craft, there was actually an inner and an outer column which counter-rotated in opposite directions. Now, if you, I think it was Nick Pope, or was it Timothy Good, wrote a book, I think it was called Above Top Secret.
That was Timothy.
Yes. He had described finding some research that was being done by the Nazis up in the, I think it was the Wenceslas mine in Poland, that involved an object called the Bell, and it actually employed a system very much like this with a couple of counter-rotating cylinders that were buried inside of a ceramic sort of bell-shaped device using mercury, thorium, and beryllium peroxide, which just happened to be some of the same kind of components that have been described as having been used in these propulsion systems. And so, I began to think that maybe some of these people who were claiming that they had been abducted by aliens really were onto something, that they were not just making this stuff up.
All right, stay with us. Back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Mark McClendish. Mark, what are you working on now these days?
Well, I've actually got a custom car project I'm working on. I'm doing some design work in that area. I'm also doing a series of illustrations for a major boat manufacturer. And I've got a few other projects I really can't talk about that I'm working on that are very interesting. But I'm actually thinking of branching out and more into an area of science fiction and fantasy, fantastic art, I think they call it. The kind of stuff that Frank Frazetta and others like him have done. And looking forward to that.
I'm going to get you in touch with Larry Niven, one of the great science fiction writers.
Well, that'd be great. I love science fiction.
Yeah, we can do things like that for you.
Yeah, that would be great.
This whole picture that you've looked at over the years is leading you to come away with what kind of a question and then what kind of an answer?
Well, I think the question on everybody's mind about this sort of technology is, if it exists, why is it still secret? I mean, if it's been, 47 to 2006, we're looking at, 60 years or something?
Yeah, what are we holding back for?
This is the same sort of question I think you posed to me the last time we were here, and I think the answer is still the same, and that is that the technology that they have, and it really does exist, is the one thing that gives us a strategic edge in the world with nations like Iran threatening to develop nuclear weapons and throw them at their neighbors, the prospects of North Korea doing something like that as well, the idea that we might attack one of these countries, and frankly, the prospect of doing that is ludicrous. In spite of whatever Kim Jong Il thinks, it'd be silly for us to do that because their fallout would all drift back to Canada, the United States, with the prevailing winds. So it's not like we're going to do that tomorrow. But so the real question remains: if they have the technology, why is it secret? Why haven't we heard about it? Why aren't they using it commercially? And as far as I'm aware, there are a number of efforts being made right now, not only in this country but around the world, to try and find a way to bring out this technology in a way that doesn't threaten its military applications and at the same time allows for things like power production without the toxic byproducts that you get from fossil fuels, power production without the radioactivity that you find with nuclear power plants, and power production that can be taken and modularized and moved out into remote areas where people living in little communities in third world countries would be able to use, something the size of a couple of suitcases to produce energy for an entire village.
Sounds like Tesla would have been happy, Mark.
Oh, he would have. This is exactly the kind of thing that I think that he probably eventually visualized with the project that he had at Wardenclyffe, this giant tower that was basically kicking the Earth's electromagnetic field in such a way that it would be in resonance. And then if you tune to a particular frequency by, you know, driving a stake into the ground and putting an antenna up in the air, that you could tune into the same frequency and draw energy from it to power whatever your local needs might be. I think even Art Bell has talked about the antenna system that he had when he was living in Pahrump, that by, you know, driving a you know, something that would thwart lightning strikes into the ground and then having a wire way up in the air, that he was actually able to get a certain amount of voltage off the wires that came from his antenna. And this was, you know, not some kind of radio signal that was coming in, but it was actually an electrical differential between the wire that's up in the sky and the Earth itself.
I think he was putting power back on the grid, too, wasn't he?
Well, that I don't know about. I mean, I know that he had a number of systems that he might have even been using some kind of a photovoltaic array, you know, solar cells to help generate electricity. I'm really not that familiar
with
it.
I'm sure he did, though.
Well, it certainly is possible. I mean, out in the desert like that, there's plenty of sunshine to draw from.
Mark, the anti-gravity propulsion, how serious have we been in trying to develop that? Have we developed that?
Well, you know, I don't know if anti-gravity is the correct term. There's been a little bit of debate about what exactly to call it. Some refer to it as a kind of a mass drive or a mass cancellation drive. Anti-gravity is kind of a you know, sort of a common term for the particular system. But the characteristics of this thing performing or operating are really they are, you see the kinds of performance that are often reported with UFOs, and that is that you have things that are moving at tremendous velocities. They're not producing any kind of supersonic shock wave. They're making accelerations from a complete stop to thousands of miles an hour in you know, just a few seconds, if almost instantly, sometimes appearing as though they just completely disappear from view rather than actually
right.
moving away. They just move away so fast, it looks like they just wink out.
So it's not like they go through a different portal.
Well, you know, that is one of the aspects that is seen with some of the systems. Now, just like we have all different kinds of ways of making airplanes fly, whether it's with a jet engine, a scramjet engine, or a propeller, I'm sure that there's probably you know, at least two or three different ways to make an anti-gravity propulsion system work. Just to give you an example, one of the witnesses that I encountered after the last show was a fellow who had been part of a special ops team that was operating inside East Germany right before the Berlin Wall came down in May of 1989, and he and his team were redirected to a crash site of a U.S. Reconnaissance aircraft that had crashed about 25 miles southeast of Halle, East Germany, which is right near Leipzig. It's just a few kilometers over the border. And he and his crew came in by helicopter and were escorted by a number of other, like Apache or those sort of fully armed combat-type helicopters. And the vehicle that he found on the ground was one of these flying triangles, but it was of a different type completely than from what any other thing that I've heard of in the past. This one, imagine a sort of shallow three-sided pyramid with one particular corner, one particular point going out quite a bit longer than the other two sides. And it was approximately, the best estimate that we've made was that it was about 12 to 13 feet wide at the leading edge, which was sort of the base of the triangle, if you will, like an arrowhead flying backwards, if you...
That's pretty small, though, isn't it?
And I'm sorry?
That's pretty small, isn't it?
Well, in this particular case, it was not a very big aircraft. It was a two-man vehicle. It was about 20 to 24 feet in length, maybe 12 to 13 feet wide. Had a cockpit remarkably similar to a stealth fighter, with sort of a sawtooth edge on the lip of the canopy, had an interior cockpit that looked an awful lot like an F-16. But the thing that set it apart and made it have some elements in common with a lot of other these triangle sightings was that under each corner it had a sphere. Now, this is something that was reported in Denmark when they had the sightings back in the 1990s. It's been reported in parts of the southern United States, a number of areas. But there's only been a handful of sightings where the triangle actually looked as though it was an arrowhead flying backwards through the air. Most of the time, it looks like, you know, your typical delta wing aircraft where the pointy part of the aircraft is in the lead. In this case, it was just the opposite. And the thing that was interesting was that the aircraft had been flying a nap of the earth mission, you know, where you go down in the valleys and stuff to avoid detection as much as possible. And coming up over a rise, the aircraft had clipped the left front corner with the top of a pine tree, severing about 10 to 15 feet of that tree, and then crashing into a hillside, landing tail first, breaking the tail up and forward, kind of like the tail of a scorpion. And as it did so, the third sphere that was back near the tail section actually was broken free and was floating around the field near where the crash occurred. And the soldier that I interviewed, now retired, indicated that his particular assignment, his group, was to go out and to recover this sphere. Now, he described the sphere as looking like a white a pumpkin. He said he almost got the impression that it was made of kind of a sort of a white translucent plastic or glass.
Mm-hmm.
And it was striated like a pumpkin would be, you know, with the little seams that run from the top to the bottom, converging
right
at the top and the bottom. He indicated that each one of the ridges that ran from top to bottom had an additional set of scalloping, kind of like the scales on the back of a scallop shell or the terracotta tiles, the curved terracotta tiles that you see on the roof of the old mission-style architecture from Southern California from, you know, the turn of the century. But he said that the object was all white, that it was spinning furiously like a wobbly, crazy top. And he said right on the top of it was a sort of what looked like a silver steel sphere that was flush with the top of it, and it looked like it had sort of a single wire coming out of the top of it. Now, the interesting thing here is that if you go back and you look at some of the earlier UFO cases, like the Tahunga Kangan sightings northwest of Los Angeles from the 60s, 70s, some in the 80s, one of the abductees who had written a book about this particular series of events described a propulsion system that she had seen while she was abducted that involved glass components to the propulsion system. And one of the features of that was that there was a liquid with some kind of suspended particles that would spin inside of a glass container. And by having a sort of like a propeller-like appliance on the inside, spinning this mixture of particles on the inside of this glass containment vessel, that it would create a tremendous amount of static electricity that was then redirected and used to propel the aircraft. And so it looks as though, from what this fellow has described to me, is that this particular aircraft used something, some sort of spin-off of that, pardon the pun, of the same kind of technology, and that this was somehow what helped this thing to move about.
Well, I got to tell you, there's a lot going on out there, Mark, and again, the big question is why isn't it ever revealed? Part of us, you know, who are believers, just think that the technology may not be mastered yet. Maybe that's why.
Well, you know, there have been a number of reported crashes. I think Bob Lazar talked about some of those kinds of events occurring. And it only stands to reason in any kind of early flight test program, whether it's a conventional aircraft or something really exotic like, you know, something that uses anti-gravity, that you're going to have times where the pilot, either because his senses are somehow impaired by the field that is created by this propulsion system, he may not be able to really understand where he is in time and space in terms of his position above the ground, how fast he's going. Imagine if you have a propulsion system that completely eliminates the weight of the aircraft or completely cancels the mass of the aircraft.
Right.
It means that everything in the aircraft, including the pilot, has the sensation of being weightless. Now, you've heard of the Vomit Comet, the training aircraft. It's a KC-135 or C-135 that is like a 707 that the military takes, and they fly it up in an arching trajectory, which kind of goes up and then drops off the far side. And as it's descending, anyone who's inside becomes weightless, and they float around, and they can train the astronauts to as to what it would be like to be in a weightless environment. Well, imagine trying to control an aircraft when you feel completely weightless. In one of the orientation rides that I had in an F-4 Phantom back in the 1980s, the pilot pushed the nose over in the same kind of thing into a negative G kind of situation, is what they call it, negative G forces. And every little particle of dust in the whole cockpit became airborne. It looked like it was smoking in the cockpit from the dust that rose up out of, you know, every little nook and cranny around the ejection seat and everything else. And so when you imagine a pilot and everything in the cockpit that suddenly becomes weightless, it takes a tremendous amount of training to be able to teach someone how to fly an aircraft that has that kind of an effect on your body. I mean, even in the early days of propeller-driven aircraft, when they began to understand what G-forces were about, before they had G-suits that would, you know, basically squeeze your legs and your abdomen to keep the blood pressure to your brain up and prevent you from passing out. These were things that they had to learn about, trial and error. And so as time went on, I mean, it's like anything else. You go from a Model T to a Corvette, you know, built in 1999, 2006, whatever. You're talking about a tremendous advancement in technology from one to the other. And I think the same is probably true of any alien aircraft that comes from another world or something that we're developing here, that there's a learning curve that over time, even the designs that people report seeing have changed. They've gotten more sophisticated. They've become shinier, smoother, more aerodynamic, capable of things that the early sightings never would have imagined. They never would have, you know, suggested by the performance that we saw back in the 40s and the 50s and the stuff we see now, especially some of the sightings that have been filmed down near Gulf Breeze, where you see a silver disc in the sky and then it's gone. It's gone so fast. It almost looks as though it disappeared.
Yeah, you know, you're right about it, and it defies logic. Are you at a belief where you believe these craft are physical as opposed to multidimensional?
Well, you know, I it's interesting because I think that there's an aspect of both of those types of characteristics occurring not only within the same kind of vehicle but also in the different types of vehicles that have been described. I met a former B-52 navigator at an air show at El Toro right before the base was closed in Southern California, down near Tustin, where he described a sighting. His B-52 had been damaged by a surface-to-air missile, and they had been in Guam for a couple of weeks while the aircraft was being repaired. And as they're flying back to their base near South Vietnam, one of the pilots called out that there was something really strange pacing their aircraft. And he said, we looked out the window, and here we are, you know, over the Pacific Ocean, not a cloud in the sky. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. There's a full moon directly south of us. And he said that here was this vehicle, this saucer-shaped aircraft that had to have been conservatively estimated between a quarter of a mile and a half a mile in diameter. And he said, and the way they kind of figured this out was the fact that it had a dome that looked like a single giant casting of transparent lucite glowing. And he says, we could see the shadows, the floors of each floor inside of this dome. And he says, we counted 27 stories. And he said, we could see the shadows and silhouettes of little people walking around in there. And he says, and so if you took the 27-story-tall dome and you laid it over on its side and then you sort of, you know, lay those that length end-to-end and you measure it out and you figure, well, 27-story building times 10 or 15, that might be, you know, between a quarter of a mile and a half a mile in diameter. Now, he said that they saw a number of features of this thing. They flew all around it, and because the electronics in the B-52 is shielded against the electromagnetic nuclear pulse that's produced by nuclear weapons if they go off, they felt that their electronics were shielded, and that was why they were able to get so close to this thing. But he said this was something that the scientists and the FBI were very interested in when they were debriefed after this mission, was that when this thing departed, when it flew away from them, he said this thing spooled up and it left within, it was out of sight within 2 or 3 seconds, but he said in its wake was this shimmering tube that looked like a tunnel. And he says, and in that tunnel, inside of this, we could see what appeared to be a daylit sky with clouds. And he says, we got the distinct impression that what we were able to see, we were looking through this, like a wormhole, that this craft had created that allowed it to travel almost instantaneously around to the far side of the Earth where the sun was shining and there was a cloud-filled sky.
That's amazing. Isn't that incredible?
Oh, it's stunning.
My God.
It's stunning. I mean, and to think that a craft that size could accelerate and disappear from view in just a few seconds. I mean, you obviously have to have a system of propulsion that cancels the weight and the mass of the aircraft so that it's the whole thing becomes like just a big feather that you're pushing along with a tremendous amount of power.
We're going to talk a little bit about that downed F-89C Scorpion. Remember that case, Mark?
Looking forward to that.
We'll be back with you in a moment. Mark, about a month or so ago, Linda Bolton I was on our program. She talked about an F-89C Scorpion that was discovered on the bottom of Lake Superior with some kind of object near it. You're familiar with this case?
Yes.
What's your take?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of debate about what exactly is going on with the aircraft and this object that's near it. There's been some kind of electromagnetic phenomenon associated with the object. Anytime that they got near this with their equipment, that there seemed to be some problems, some anomalies. I think Linda did a pretty effective job of describing all of that. But a couple of the observations that I made was that you know, when I looked at the image of this F-89 on the bottom, and it was really kind of hard to really grasp what I was looking at because this side scan sonar system that they sort of cobbled together from a software program and a fish finder produces kind of a shadow, so it's very difficult by looking at this series of blotches, the black areas and so forth, to tell exactly what you're looking at. And so what I wound up doing is creating a drawing based on that image, sort of turning it around, because on their website, I believe the image is actually upside down and backwards. But if you turn it all around, and in this drawing, I was able to map out where the aircraft actually is and what the features visible are on the aircraft, and it also included some of the contouring on the bottom of the Lake Superior where this thing was found. And there's a couple things I can say. Number one, this is an aircraft that probably flew. It was one of the early jet aircraft, straight wing, tip tanks, wing temps, tanks out on the wingtips, and a number of machine guns and things inside of it, also capable of launching missiles. This is an aircraft that empty was about 26,000 pounds, and with a full load of fuel and weapons was something in excess of 46,000 pounds, fully loaded. And so you have to understand that when something that weighs that much, and when it could be doing something in the order of, you know, if it's going full throttle and hits the ocean or hits the surface of the water of the lake at maybe 450 miles an hour, it would disintegrate. It would be in pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to ask yourself, how is it that this aircraft is laying on the bottom completely intact, as far as we can tell? There was some debate about the left wing missing, but if you really carefully study the contours there, you'll see that behind and slightly to the right of the aircraft, there appears to be the initial impact where either the nose or the right wing tip hit the bottom of the lake. And then it basically rolled to the left and slid forward, and it basically buried the left wing under the silt. Now, with an aircraft that weighs as much as this thing does, even if it was completely empty at 26,000 pounds, if there was a whole lot of silt on the bottom, this thing would be completely buried. You would not be able to see probably even the tail sticking up through the silt. And you have to remember that the bottom of the Great Lakes was ground out of solid bedrock by the action of glaciers receding thousands and thousands of years ago. So we're not talking a mushy, soft bottom at all. This is a hard rock bottom with maybe 2 to 3 feet of silt. So if you take all these things into consideration, and then you look at the fact that the fuselage just forward of the cockpit has some oil canning and some wrinkles, it appears as though this thing probably, you know, once it sank after it ditched and got into the water and it sank, it probably glided to the bottom, you know, like a penguin going through the water, sort of gliding, you know, sort of like a leaf falling through the air, down to the bottom, hits the bottom. The backbone of the aircraft is bent a little bit. The nose of it is curled up. And so you see wrinkles in the surface of the aircraft. Now, from the scans, I couldn't detect whether there are any bodies remaining of the two pilots in the cockpit. It almost looks as though the canopy, the acrylic canopy, is still intact as well. But you have to wonder if the whole story behind this, encountering a UFO, going out to intercept this unknown object that's moving around the Great Lakes area, and you're in the middle of a storm in November, it's icy, it's cold, it's wet, there's rain falling, you don't have a very good radar system to rely on, and you make this encounter. Now, let's say that it really is a UFO, and it really has an anti-gravity propulsion system, and these things were renowned at that time for disabling the electrical systems of cars, houses, and aircraft as well. And so how would it be possible if an aircraft suddenly, of this vintage, suddenly lost its jet engines, suddenly lost its power? And you have to remember that this is one of the early aircraft where the earliest jet aircraft had a hydraulic pump that was driven off a transmission that was connected to the jet engines. And so the minute the engines fail, all of your control surfaces basically are out of your reach. You can no longer control them. So the aircraft that I worked on in the Air Force was the F-106, which was developed slightly later than when this event occurred. But one of the solutions that they came up with for this very problem, not UFOs necessarily, but an engine flameout and the loss of flight system control, was they had a little tiny panel that would pop out on the side of the aircraft with a fan on it, and the fan was connected to a pump. And the air flowing past the aircraft would spin the propeller on the fan, and the pump would pressurize the hydraulic system so the pilot, even without any jet engine powering the aircraft, could glide and very roughly control where the aircraft was going as it descended without much power, other than the weight of the aircraft and gravity pulling it down towards the ground. And so it's entirely possible that this pilot, skillfully, I might add, might have been able to deploy this emergency hydraulic power pump device, control the aircraft, and make a soft ditch landing on the surface of Lake Superior, and then either upon landing, get out and deploy some kind of a dinghy or a rubber raft or something. There's no telling, what they might have used. But in any event, you're talking about freezing water. And, miles and miles from shore. This occurred just over the Canadian border, right smack dab in the middle of Lake Superior.
Well, this is also, I think it was close to where the Edmund Fitzgerald eventually went down.
That I don't know about. It's possible. But the thing that made this whole thing so interesting and so provocative was the fact that 215 feet from the crash of this aircraft resting on the bottom is this sort of teardrop-shaped object laying on the bottom. And there was a lot of speculation that, well, maybe this is the cupola or the dome of a flying saucer, and there's a complete flying saucer buried below the what we can see in the silt. And I can tell you that at only 215 feet away from the F-89, I'm pretty sure that the bottom geology of the lake is not much different than where that F-89 is. And so, if you've got a 26,000 to 46,000-pound aircraft sitting on the surface, chances are whatever that, teardrop-shaped thing is, it's not much bigger than what you can actually see.
Could that be a parachute?
The object itself?
Yeah. I mean,
well, it has a rigid metallic composition from what they've said. So I doubt that it is a parachute. Although it turns out that this just happens to coincide with the earliest development of the airborne warning and aircraft control system, or AWACS type of radar system, that was an airborne radar platform. The earliest version was mounted on the old Lockheed Constellation, which was a straight-wing, four-engine, propeller-driven aircraft that was used in the earliest days of airliner service. This was the one that had the three tails across the back. This was an aircraft they used for airliners in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And so in fact, I think the early version of it was referred to as the WV-2 or the EC-121. Now, you can take those two terms and look them up on Google, and you can actually find images of this aircraft. And what it was is a Lockheed Constellation with a radome right underneath the center of the fuselage, right where the fairing at the root of the main wing joined with the fuselage. And it just happens to have a teardrop shape that matches almost identically the dimensions of this object, which I think they say is something like 8 or 9 feet across and maybe 11 or 12 feet long. And it has a somewhat teardrop shape to it. It's metal except for the leading edge or the blunt end of the teardrop shape, which was the orifice, I guess you would say, from which the radar signal was transmitted, which was sort of a cone of vision that was probably 45 degrees off the center line of the aircraft.
Okay,
so
let's go.
If the two aircraft collided, and you know, if this EC 121 was considered classified, it was state of the art, it was part of the early picket line warning system that we had when we started worrying about the Russians coming across the North Pole and all that kind of stuff. So if you look at all that stuff and you imagine that this was an early development prototype that may have been classified, the early radars had an unusual capability of appearing to, especially when they were airborne, jumping around because of the Doppler effect and other things that would happen with the ground-based radar and the ground control units getting these signals, you would get this effect where it would look like things could move around faster than they really were able to. And they can still do this kind of thing today with the proper technology. But the point being that if these two aircraft, you know, and this is all hypothetical, of course, but if these two aircraft collided, and there's some evidence that the tail section of the F-89 is damaged. I think it's the upper right horizontal stabilizer. If the one aircraft hit the other while it was passing underneath and it sheared off that radome cleanly, there's a possibility that it might have been able to drop that thing into the water, not too far from where the aircraft was, where the collision occurred, that is. And, you know, you look at a powerful radar system like that. I know that there was a radioactive signal source in the aircraft, the MA-1 weapons control system that we had on the F-106 that I worked on. And so it stands to reason that some of the other earlier airborne radar control systems or radar systems may have also used a radioactive signal source, may have employed some very powerful electromagnets that may be attributable to some of the anomalies that have been experienced around this object, you know, whatever it may be. But this is just, you know, one possible idea.
Okay, let's go to the phones.
Okay.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jim from Santa Clarita.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Howdy. I wanted to call and confirm that description of Mark's about the huge triangular-shaped flying craft. I live out in Santa Clarita, and my uncle's a highway patrolman, and he called me one night, told me to get outside and look, that there was, over the Highway 14, Antelope Valley Freeway, there was a triangular aircraft the size of a football field. And it had, I went out and I saw it. It had regular aircraft, you know, landing lights on it. It was headed down the 14, followed the 5, headed straight toward Lockheed and Burbank.
Really?
And the thing only traveled maybe 500 feet in the air, and it had a speed of maybe 60 to 100 miles an hour. It was hard to tell because it was so big, but it traveled very slow.
Well, now I would like you to contact me through my website, www.markmccandlish.com, because I would like to get more details from you that we could probably get during the time of the show. So if you're willing to contact me, and even if you want to do so anonymously, you know, be happy to keep your name private and all the rest of it, but I'd really like to find out as much from you as I can.
Okay, www what?
MarkMcCandlish.com. I think there's probably a leak on the Coast to Coast website.
Okay.
But that's fascinating. Now, this was at nighttime?
Nighttime, about 9 o'clock at night.
Well, at that time, you could probably still see quite a bit, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, did this object have any kind of a texture? Was it smooth? Was it black, silver?
It was black. It was smooth. And it was completely silent. Like you describe it, there was no engine noise. No
really?
Propellers, no jets, no sound of any kind.
Now, did it have squared-off edges, or were they rounded?
They were kind of flat on the sides.
Mm-hmm.
It came to a point at the nose, and the wings were kind of like shaped like a stealth fighter, but then squared at the side, like you were talking about the Valkyrie, and flat across the back.
So it had kind of a sharp, straight-edged look to it then.
Right.
Well, this is sort of in contrast with some of the other descriptions that I've heard where We've had both designs that were sort of rectilinear and straight edges, and those that were rounded and more aerodynamic looking. This is some new and interesting information that I would really like to discuss with you at length.
Okay, and you were talking about the speed of aircraft, and you know they always lie about it because they say, well, we have an aircraft that'll do Mach 3, but what they don't tell you is the aircraft will really do Mach 8.
Mm-hmm.
I was working at an air show in Van Nuys, and we were waiting for a SR-71 to come in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the top speed of the SR-71 is or what they say it is, but it, as you said, described one coming in from Hawaii. Well, this plane was coming in from Hawaii also, and it was due in 15 minutes. And I said, yeah, right, 15 minutes. So 15 minutes went by. It didn't show up. I said, I told you it wouldn't show up. And 5 minutes later, the guy came over from the Air Force and said, it's down in Texas with technical problems.
Oh, jeez.
Well, you know, it's funny because, they have so many different kinds of aircraft, so many different mission profiles that they need to fly with these things. And the fact that oftentimes I think people misdiagnose the speed that these aircraft are going. I mean, I've looked at the C-5A in flight, and this is an immense aircraft. And the illusion is that it's going much slower than it really is because its size and its shape seems so foreign to the speed that it's actually traveling. It might be toing, 175, 210 miles an hour, and yet it looks like it's just crawling along because of the scale of the aircraft itself. And so it's entirely possible that as huge as this thing was that you saw, it may have been going quite a bit faster than you actually believe.
Okay, thanks for that call. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Hello? Yeah, go ahead, sir.
This is Stuart in Texas.
Okay,
hi, Stuart. I worked during the Cold War in the intelligence community. I worked some with military intelligence, some domestic, some foreign, and I worked over a long period of time.
Okay.
Now, you get this information from time to time. You don't even know what it pertains to. You have to wait for time to go by before you even know what information it is you have.
To get the whole picture, yeah.
Yes, you don't even get the picture. Sometimes you don't know what it pertains to, and it might pertain to something you learned years ago, and then you don't realize it until you're taking a shower
mm-hmm.
2 years later and you think of it.
Well, so did you come across something that you wanted to share with us?
Yes. I want to ask you about experimental craft that the military has.
Okay.
All right. What I'm going to say, don't think in terms of a flying saucer that's crashed or a flying saucer with aliens. Just think like this. What I want to say is the military has a flying saucer. Now, what would you say to that?
Well, I know that to be a fact.
Okay. Now, the one I saw has been so long ago that if you know so much about aircraft, you know they rebuild one every 5, 6, 7 years. They come out with a new generation aircraft, but they're in a hurry. The one I saw was so long ago that it's been long enough for them to have 4 or 5 generations newer ones than the one I saw.
Well, in fact, this is exactly what I was saying earlier to George, was the fact that these are just like the development of automobiles, that as time passes, just like any other mass-produced machine, they make improvements, they have improved technology, they have new systems that they can add and put into these things to make the performance better, faster, more stealthy, and you're exactly right.
Okay, thanks for that. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Mark McClandish. Will take your final phone calls. Already, what a fast day. This show's going by faster than that 17,000-mile-an-hour jet craft. Have you ever gotten any reports, Mark, of UFOs coming from the sea? Those things fascinate me.
Well, in fact, I have a good friend. It was one of these young ladies that I had spoken to about her abduction experiences, and she was with a group of other people at a crowded restaurant in Laguna Beach. Gosh, this must have been 1990 or so, and they saw something, some kind of glowing object under the water, just offshore. And I assume that this restaurant was, what was it, Enchilada Bob's or something. I can't remember what the name of the restaurant was. It's some funky name like that. It was one of those high quality Mexican food restaurants, and it was sort of on a bluff overlooking the ocean. And the people in the restaurant could see this thing moving around under the ocean, glowing. And apparently it came up out of the water, hovered for a few moments, and then sped off. And shortly after it became airborne, she said that it looked like a couple of F-14s from El Toro came zooming over the community and went out to sea following this thing.
Gee.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine?
I've had calls from sailors or people who have been on ships, Mark, and they see these objects bursting right out of the ocean. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they just take off. They're gone.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. Who was it? Bill Cooper. I think he wrote the book called Behold a Pale Horse.
Yeah, the late Bill Cooper, by the way.
One of the things that I had spoken to him a number of years ago, and as it turns out, he was in the submarine service at the same time I was in the Air Force. And I was stationed in McCord Air Force Base, which was just in Tacoma, just south of Seattle. And, of course, he was based at a sub-base that was at Bremerton, which was, I believe, south and a little bit west of Seattle. And there was an occasion while I was in the service where the alert aircraft, and these are aircraft that each had nuclear weapons, four of them. We had an alert hangar, a couple of radar-seeking missiles, a couple of infrared-seeking missiles, and we had an alert where we got a call from the control tower saying that there was a covered wagon, and this was a code word that meant that we have an unknown enemy aircraft off the coast, and an intercept is required immediately. And so we jumped into the truck with our tool bags, and we went out there, and these two aircraft were firing up the engines, and we made sure all the electronics on the guidance and weapons control systems timed in properly. They went out to the end of the runway, brought it up to full afterburner while they were holding the brakes. I mean, it's just the kind of thing that would just really inspire you and give you goosebumps to see these planes sitting there just lurching, wanting to go forward under this, you know, huge flame, the afterburner coming out the back. They release the brakes, scream all the way down the runway, and you could see the afterburner all the way to the horizon. That's how important this was. And whatever it was, we never heard another thing about it. But when I talked to Bill Cooper years later, it turned out that his sighting of this immense flying saucer coming out of the ocean from his submarine on the way to Hawaii, it occurred at approximately the same time that this alert, this covered wagon event occurred. And so I've always wondered whether there wasn't some coincidence there, whether there was some kind of a thing where, you know, the fighter interceptors of the 318th Fighter Interceptor Squadron had gone out there to face off with whatever it was that he saw coming out of the water.
I've always said no coincidences, so there's a reason why it happened.
I think so.
Let's go back to the phones.
Okay.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good, sir.
Great to talk to you and your guests there. And you were mentioned there earlier about this triangular-shaped possible balloon object. And I remember, I live in Ohio now, but back in the 80s, I lived down in Memphis, Tennessee, and Fred Smith's home office down there for Federal Express, he put in the newspaper one day his projection for the future of the way that they would be moving freight. And they had a technical drawing. It must have taken up half a page. It showed this triangular-shaped balloon-type craft that was so enormous that they showed even the trucks inside of it. This thing could hold over 1,000 trucks.
Well, it turns out I think I'm familiar with that particular design. That was originally developed. I think the gentleman's name was William Martin. He had a company in Princeton, New Jersey called Aerion Corporation, spelled A-E-R-E-O-N. And he had a design that was proposed and even patented in the late 1980s, early 1990s, for a large triangular airship that was called the Aerion Dyne Airship.
Right. I can't remember the name of it, but they also showed, you know, his plans on a future base for this thing. I mean, they showed like an entire airfield laid out with them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they put a 747 in the drawing next to it. It just dwarfed it. It looked like a lug nut on a Volkswagen, you know, compared to this thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of people don't really understand just how powerful buoyancy, lighter than air gases and buoyancy can be. For example, if you had an airbag with just hot air in it that was the size of a city bus, you could lift 500 pounds of steel with that. And so if you scale that up into something that's, you know, 600 feet long, 1,000 feet long, a half a mile, a mile long, you could probably lift and transport an entire armored division of M1 Abrams tanks.
Right. That was the only time I had ever seen anything in it, and I thought maybe the military got interested in it and they hushed it up. But
I think you're probably right.
And for the undersea type deal there, George, this past week I saw a deal on the History Channel there. It was like a 2-hour show I recorded. If you've got to get somebody to record that, go back and look at it. You will love it. They show you know what it looks like when you take a bowl and press it down into a bowl of flour and it leaves an indentation there?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
This craft evidently had landed in some guy's pond or some lake here, and the guy saw it take off. It left that indentation in the water. It remained there for over a week. The military came out, newspapers came out, they all videotaped it and photographed it, and I've never seen anything like that before.
Wow. That's interesting.
Okay, great. Hey, thank you very much. Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, how are you, George?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to say real quick, I think you've got one of the nicest, most professional radio personalities out there, so I'm enjoying listening to you. My question is for your guest, Mark, real quick. I'm a geology major, and we kind of toot with this sometimes in our geo club, but Mark, how often do you think we get visits from, like, other planets, aliens, I guess you could say?
How often?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's hard to say because, honestly, I think that about 85% of the sightings that we have out there right now of UFOs and vehicles that seem to exhibit performance beyond anything that man could come up with, I think about 85% of those things are classified weapons or aircraft that just happen to be in the wrong place at the right time or someone happens to see them. But I think a small percentage, maybe 15% or so, probably does represent some kind of an off-world visitation with you know, entities, beings, humanoids, whatever, that are here checking us out, looking at the progress that we're making in some areas. And, you know, I talked to an engineer who works at one of the big facilities, research facilities for NASA in the Pasadena area. And he had described talking to another engineer who seemed very worried about something that he had seen down at the White Sands missile test range a number of years ago. I think it was in the 1980s. And it was this kind of a thing where he's out in the middle of this desert, and just out of the blue he looks up and there is this what looks like a visual deformation of the sky itself where
wow.
The visual image of the sky seems to be just sucked right up into what looks like a funnel-shaped
cool.
sort of transparent tunnel that goes up into space, and at the very top, the apex of this tunnel, is a black dot.
Oh.
And in that dot, he can see what looks like a star field, and out of that dot comes a full-blown flying saucer, which drops
ooh.
Down
yeah.
and sits right at the mouth of this sort of funnel-shaped distortion in the
uh-huh.
in the visual appearance of the sky, and
yeah.
then almost immediately, pew, zips away out of sight. And he's just completely dumbfounded by this, and he said that within a half an hour, the vehicle, whatever it was, returns to the exact same position. This distortion again appears in the sky above him, and the thing is just appears to be almost sucked up into this sort of vortex or this funnel-shaped
wow.
tunnel that goes up into the sky, and it's gone. And all of this without so much as a noise. And so, you know, when you're in what is known to be a restricted airspace that's, you know, exclusively military, and you see something like that, you really have to question, is this one of ours or is it from somewhere else?
Mark, could I?
Yes.
George, could I splice to something?
Yeah.
If it's okay, do you think we have any aliens living among us that are like, they have human
uh-huh.
figures and all that? Like, I mean...
Well,
that sounds like a crazy question.
That's a good question. I'll let you listen on your radio because you're breaking up just a little bit. If you believe in extraterrestrial visitations, then I think you have to believe that it's possible that aliens are among us. Don't you think, Mark?
Well, I think it's a possibility. I mean, if you look at the incredible spectrum of life that comes from, you know, just the basic components of DNA, and all of the variations that can be created from that, all of the different cycles of evolution, all the different species, you know, the millions of species of insects alone should be a pretty good indication of, you know, you can have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different bodies that all have, you know, two eyes, a head, six legs, two wings, and maybe a set of pinchers. And I think the same is probably true of human beings or the humanoid type of being, and that is that, you know, there are probably components that have a natural affinity for combining to produce, you know, bipedal organisms that walk on two legs upright and use their hands and their arms to manipulate the environment around them. And eventually, you know, they rub two sticks together, get fire, and off we go. So, yeah, I think it's possible.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah.
I got a little personal story that involves Chuck Yeager. I was about 10 years ago, I was at Oshkosh, and they have, like, all these different, where you can go one-to-one, talk to people, ask questions, and it
right.
was sponsored by Champion.
Okay.
And Chuck, he was up there with his wingman from World War II, Bud Anderson. And they're, like, on a stage. There's, like, about 300 of us. And they're asking, you know, typical questions, you know, what they did and how they did it and what have you. And there was, like, a guy that was kind of like a narrator. He was, like, a go-between guy. He would, like, reiterate the question after the question was asked.
Okay.
And then towards the end of the show, I happened to get a question in. I says, General, I says, the whole time you've been flying, I says, all these different aircraft, did you ever see a UFO? And this guy, he was going to reiterate the question, and Bud Anderson and Chuck Yeager, they were sitting down. As soon as he heard that, he hopped up out of his seat, he grabbed the microphone, he said, I heard that, and he just read me a riot act like you wouldn't believe. And the whole place went hush, like we're talking like a couple hundred people. And he got all red in the face, and then finally when he got done, he says to me, he says, you must have been hanging out at the bar with the little green men. He said, you must have been drunk or something like that. And he's just, like, reading me the riot act. And finally, by the way he said it, I knew he must have seen something. And after that, he just, like, calmed down, and he says, oh, no, I've never really seen anything. No, all the whole time I've been flying, nothing. I haven't seen anything.
What's that old phrase from Shakespeare? Methinks thou doth protest too much.
Protest too much. That's exactly right. Hey, thanks for the call. Appreciate you being on Coast to Coast. Next up, Wildcard Line. You're up with us. Hi there.
Hey, yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Before down to Earth, my son and I were hiking way out in the desolate southeast corner of Oregon in the winter, and down in those canyons, the military comes over from the Air Force Base southeast of Boise. And the jets come over and fly around there and do maneuvers and stuff. We've seen them occasionally, but hardly anybody's ever there, so I think they feel they're pretty private. We got me down in Leslie's Gulch, this real canyon, narrow little area, invisible, and these two F-16s came down. They stalled out, and they hovered like 200 feet off the ground and were able to sit on their engines and maneuver, rotate around each other within, say, 40 feet of each other, look each other in the cabin, and kind of practice maneuvering 100 feet off the ground down in a canyon very close to rocks. I mean, they were maybe 50 feet from a rock canyon, and then they just put it on, leaned it out, and took off. So is there some computer that's running their nozzles to control that?
Well, as it turns out, the X-31 that I described earlier, which was a cover story for Popular Science in February of 1989, that particular aircraft does have some characteristics that look very similar to an F-16, except that the inlet for the engine in the front is more of a box shape. And it has a pair of these little canards that are just on either side of the cockpit, very similar to an F-16 in appearance. I would say more like the F-16XL, which had kind of a crank delta wing. But
sure.
it had a number of paddles down near the exhaust port that would permit the flight control system to vector the thrust coming off the tail end of the aircraft. Now you're sure that these were F-16s and not Harriers?
No, I know a Harrier, and I know the Warthogs. I've seen those down there.
Okay.
But this was that sleeker-looking
mm-hmm.
Air Force jet,
mm-hmm.
and I was just shocked that they could sit there and maneuver around in mm-hmm. perfect. I mean, it wasn't any jitters like the computer took over.
Sure.
They just did such smooth ballet around each other.
Wow.
Like they could drop in a canyon and hide and jump out on people or something.
Well, now, what was the date on this? Can you remember when this happened?
About, it'd be like December 15th, 2001, 2002.
Oh, okay. Well, see, that changes the picture because the X-31 Actually, I believe it was prototyped and built. There were a couple of them built. And I believe that they were actually flying in the early 1990s and that the prototypes still exist. Now, were the aircraft painted any particular color? Were they white and blue by any chance?
No, no, they were that military dull kind of a gray.
Air superiority gray, okay.
Yeah, yeah, very low markings, just almost nil. And yet, when they took off, they just punched it. You know?
I bet.
It was just... You know,
bet they did.
Well,
that's amazing. It's an amazing sight.
And my silly son, he didn't charge the battery on our little Sony cam, and I was like, I could have killed him.
Well, thank
anyway,
you for your call.
It was really weird. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, just a couple minutes to go, Mark. For people who want more information on you, what do they do?
Well, they can log on to my website. It's www.markmccandlish.com. It's MarkMccandlish. LISH. Now, I'm offering a special for your listeners. Anyone who wants to go up there and see the website can do that. And if they would care to register on the website, I'm going to be giving, there's going to be a random drawing for one of four different aviation-related lithographs that I have. I've got one for the F-16, the F-14, the F-18, and the B-20-25 Mitchell from the Second World War, which is a historically accurate piece, and it's a limited edition. So if they'd like to do that, there's also a contact email that's given on the website there, and there's a number of images that I you wouldn't believe the hacking that I encountered this afternoon when I was gearing up for the show, and unfortunately I wasn't able to send Lex as many images as I would like, but
right. There
will be the drawing of the F-89 on the bottom of Lake Superior there, along with some other images, including some things having to do with Aurora, the stealth blimp that we talked about. Some things having to do with some of the UFOs. In fact, right in that same area, in fact, I thought this gentleman who just called was going to lead up to a story about a major UFO sighting near Cedarville, California, which is just south of the area he described. And it had...
No time to get into that, Mark. The clock has got us, my friend.
Okay. Sorry. Well, I look forward to the next time, George.
You take care. You've been a great guest.
Thank you.
Mark McClandish. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.